Consider that age 50 is right about when people who have worked all their lives start to have some money to spend and the time to spend it. Older people have an image problem. As a culture, we're conditioned toward youth. When we think of youth, we think of energetic and colorful. When we think of middle age or mature, we think of tired and washed out. And when we think of old or senior, we think either exhausted and gray, or, more likely, we just don't think. The financial numbers are absolutely inarguable. The mature market has the money, yet advertisers remain astonishingly indifferent to them. 12.7.7. A little more icing on the old folks' cake. Forrester Research. Age 55 plus are more active in online finance, shopping, and entertainment than those under 55. Kauffman Foundation. The United States, 1996 to 2007. Highest rate of entrepreneurial startup activity was ages 55 to 64. Lowest rate, ages 20 to 34. 12.7.8. Concluding note, not an initiative. I have offered very little commentary in this section. This, I believe, is one of those times when the collective statistics really do speak for themselves. Or, perhaps more accurately, these stats outline in incontrovertible terms an incredibly large opportunity in an incredibly large, incredibly underserved market. So, please get off your bloody millennials high horse and get on the horse that will take you straight to the bank. I and mine, we oldies, have the money, 47 times more, and have the time, 50% at age 50, to spend it. Note, not an initiative. As I said in the last section, referring to the enormity of women's purchasing power, seriously attempting to take advantage of an opportunity of this size requires far more than the 2018 Old Folks Initiative. It requires a stem-to-stern assessment of organizational skills and assets and culture that could be brought to bear on the oldies' marketplace spending power, trillions upon trillions of dollars. I think it is likely, in fact certain, that this is the greatest marketplace opportunity considered in this book. And the wonderful news is that most of your competitors are idiots on this topic. Presumably you're not, right? 12.8. The value-added asset number one narrative. The big duh. Our people. Fully engaged. Innovators all. Number one value-added driver. It would be inappropriate to conclude this chapter without mentioning the obvious. Our topic is value-added strategies. And I believe that the eight we have just examined and a ninth in chapter 11, while hardly an exhaustive set, do offer, in each instance, an enormous opportunity. However, none of these opportunities can in any way, shape, or form be realized unless we take the lessons of chapter 5 very seriously. That is, unless we put people really first. For example, and recall, hire nice people, hire for listening, caring, smiling, saying thank you, and being warm, and character. Make training investment number one, and create training courses that routinely merit supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Ask all of our leaders to be, in effect, dream managers, committed to helping every employee grow in a way that will make her or him a lifelong learner, more valuable on the labor market when she or he leaves than when she or he arrived. Aim to be a best place to work. As we saw, that aspiration is achievable in groceries and hospitality and on tea plantations, not just in Google world or Facebook world. My favorite expressions of all this were from entrepreneur and customer service guru John DeJulius. Your customers will never be any happier than your employees. And from Zingerman's Ari Weinzweig. If you want staff to give great service to staff. I repeat, None of the value-added opportunities covered in this and the prior chapter will even approach takeoff speed unless we pour heart, soul, and wallet into developing a peerless, turned-on, personal growth-obsessed workforce. Section 6. Leadership Excellence. Chapter 13. Listening, the Bedrock of Leadership Excellence. My Story. This is a story about a beautiful woman, a dinner in Paris. In the evening, I kept my mouth shut. I was on my way from 2 all-day seminars in London to an all-day seminar in Munich and had a day in between. I decided on the spur of the moment to make a stop in Paris, a city I love. Moreover, I had a friend who lived an hour outside the city who I hadn't seen since my Stanford days a decade before. She had been a teaching assistant while pursuing her PhD. I told her I was coming through and asked her if she was free, and if so, would she consider hopping a train to the city in return for a meal at the restaurant of her choosing. She said she'd enjoy a visit and picked a lovely little restaurant for our long overdue rendezvous. It was great to see her, but, alas, I was no charming social butterfly that evening. I was brutally exhausted and heading for more exhaustion. Delighted though I was with her company, I needed a strategy to make it through the dinner that minimized exercising my conversational skills. So after a bit of catching up, I pretty much said, "Janet, we've known each other for years, but in fact I think I barely know you. How about the story of Janet, starting more or less at conception?" In effect, I then sat back and listened with only a "mmm" or "amazing" thrown in from time to time. Her saga was incredible. Roots in an isolated town in Canada, breaking out via a series of unlikely events, and so on. And it ended with musings about her current job and fascinating work at an international research institute focused on the future of work. It was pleasurable, and I learned so damn many things about so damn many things that my head was swimming for days. Though I was indeed fond of her, this was no romantic tale, and after dinner I taxied to my hotel, where I would be picked up at 4 a.m. to begin my next act, and she went off to a good friend's pad in the City of Light. I did hear from her a few days later, and, in addition to pleasantries, she commented effusively that I might be the best listener she's ever known. Sorry to say, she's dead wrong. I'm usually full ADD, a shitty listener and a serial interrupter. But her comment got me thinking about people, particularly leaders, I especially admired. I realized that pretty much uniformly, the best of the best are extraordinary listeners. With apparent ease and many head nods, they drag stuff out of you. Facts, observations, opinions, confessions, things you barely knew existed. For example, one of my local friends is a retired financial services CEO. Every time I get home from a dinner in conversation with him, I realize anew that we talked for an hour, and he barely said a word. It's not that I rambled on like a blathering idiot, I hope not anyway, but that he asked fascinating and probing questions and follow-up questions, and then more questions as we dove into this or that generally serious topic. And then he went silent and let me speak my piece. I shared my observation with his wife, and she laughed out loud and said, "You've tripped over David's big success secret. He is a listener extraordinaire." Bravo to him. Listening deservedly earns the top slot in this leadership section and decidedly merits a standalone chapter. We doubtless all agree about the importance of listening, but rarely behave accordingly. We probably think we're pretty good at it, but with all due respect, in 5 of 6 cases we are likely delusional. Hence, unlike my banker friend who is a listener extraordinaire, we throw away a golden opportunity to enhance our leadership effectiveness. Please think about that as you peruse this chapter. The Listening Excellence Narrative. 13.1. Listening. The best way to persuade someone is with your ears, by listening to them. Former U.S. Secretary of State Dean Rusk. It's a great one-liner. More important, quite possibly, or most certainly, a life-altering idea. 13.2. Listening equals quote-unquote, fierce attention. Listening is strategy. It's amazing how this seemingly small thing, simply paying fierce attention to another, really asking, really listening, even during a brief conversation, can evoke such a wholehearted response. Susan Scott, Fierce Conversations, Achieving Success at Work and in Life, One Conversation at a Time. Attention is one thing. Fierce attention resides on a different planet. Fierce attention is a degree of attentiveness that is palpable, that makes you, the one responding to the comment or question, feel fully engaged and at the center of the universe and feel as if you damn well better say something useful and coherent. You could readily say that this entire chapter is about the difference between attention and fierce attention. The adjective, fierce, says it all. Ms. Scott's book is a masterpiece, and the book implies that topics like listening and conversation can be assessed at length. Listening can be a subject of deep professional study. Yes, as studyable as, say, accounting or neurosurgery. Listening is strategy. And turning everyone into a full-fledged listening professional is an entirely plausible notion. If fierce is a key word here, so too is professional. The point is not to listen or even to get better at listening. The point is to unabashedly make listening, fierce listening, the centerpiece of your existence, to make it no less than your strategic strength, strategic differentiator number one. It is so easy to write the words above and so very, very difficult to bring them to life. The idea of listening as a topic of formal study, of listening as a profession or calling, is far from commonplace. I'll bet not 1 in 100 readers has studied a textbook on listening or taken a training course exclusively devoted to listening. I am hoping that this chapter, positioned as the number one leadership key, will at least give you pause, that you will ponder the idea that animates the chapter and talk about it with colleagues, and then, maybe, just maybe, move in the direction suggested here. 13.3. The 18 Seconds Syndrome. Jerome Groopman, a physician and Harvard Med School professor, wrote, How Doctors Think. He asserts that the key to collecting useful information and solving the patient's health puzzle is to let the patient say her or his piece. Yet Groopman cites research that paints a rather sorry picture. Namely, the doctor interrupts the patient presenting her symptoms after 18 seconds. Over to you, dear reader. Are you an 18-second interrupter? The average doc, presumably, is like you or me, a pro who knows what he or she is talking about. Hence you, patient, launch into your tale that brought you to the examining room, and in a flash, our medico has scoped the situation and, without missing a beat, injects his or her 10 or 25 or 50 cents worth. Case closed. Write the prescription. Next. Well, the odds are actually surprisingly high that the doc has not properly scoped the problem. And even if he or she has more or less figured things out correctly, he or she surely has not made the patient feel at the center of the process. The doctor has, in fact, in a beat, marginalized the patient. It's my game, the doctor's game, not your game, the patient's game. Which is to say, we miss the whole damn point, which is, one, engagement and co-ownership of the issue. 2. Extracting useful information, which usually comes not in a flash, but from an erratic back-and-forth process that allows a reasonably coherent story and a batch of new data to eventually emerge. First step in your recovery from the 18-second syndrome, own up to the hard, harsh fact that you most likely are one of the army of 18-second interrupters. And, perhaps, with a nudge from this chapter, you can, through hard and continuous study and practice and acceptance of feedback, do something about your habit interruptus, and in the process turn a glaring weakness into no less than a towering strength. I always begin my discussion of this topic with a slide that features the 18-second quote. And when I make a comment about, "Are you an 18-second manager?" I invariably get a big laugh. You know, the kind that communicates, "You got me on that one, brother." It is the perfect intro to the topic, and the guilty clearly outnumber the innocent, starting, to be sure, with me. FYI, my goal is not to single out MDs for exhibiting this shortcoming. Though they happen to be the subject of the research finding Dr. Groopman offers us, my intent is to quickly spread the accusation to all the rest of us. 13.4. The encompassing power of listening. An obsession with listening is the ultimate mark of respect, the heart and soul of engagement and thoughtfulness, the basis for collaboration and the partnership and community, a developable individual skill, though women are, in general, notably better at it than men, the core of effective cross-functional communication, which is in turn attribute number one of organizational effectiveness, the key to making the sale, the key to keeping the customer's business, the linchpin of memorable service, the core of taking diverse opinions on board, profitable, the ROI from listening is arguably higher than from any other single activity, the bedrock that underpins a commitment to excellence. The list of benefits of an obsession with listening may feel like a laundry list dashed off in a flash, but I would urge you to go through the items one at a time and draw your own conclusions. Ultimate mark of respect. Of course. Key to making the sale. Of course. Linchpin of memorable service. Of course. I think the odds are high that's the way it'll go. And at the end of the exercise, you will perhaps begin to conclude that listening is a crucial activity and opportunity that deserves your and your organization's systematic attention as a strategic skill to be developed in one and all. 13.5. Listening is respect. It was much later that I realized Dad's secret. He gained respect by giving it. He talked and listened to the fourth grade kids in Spring Valley who shined shoes the same way he talked and listened to a bishop or college president. He was seriously interested in who you were and what you had to say. Sarah Lawrence Lightfoot, respect. I wasn't bowled over by his intelligence. What impressed me was that when he asked a question, he waited for an answer. He not only listened, he made me feel like I was the only person in the room. An attorney recounting his first meeting with renowned attorney David Bowies from Marshall Goldsmith, "The Skill That Separates," Fast Company. You doubtless have met a few standouts like the two described immediately above. The force field that individuals like this aim directly at you almost makes you step backward. I cannot suggest be like this, talk about useless. I am instead simply reminding you of the power of listening, fierce listening, and urging you one more time to make the idea and practice of listening into an enterprise-wide, as well as personal, strategic objective. 13.6. Aggressive listening. Mike Abrashoff was captain of the guided missile cruiser USS Benfold and is author of the book, It's Your Ship, Management Techniques from the Best Damn Ship in the Navy. His ship was given the U.S. Navy's highest performance evaluations, a last-to-first tale. He is now, among other things, a highly sought-after management speaker. Abrashoff shares with us the start of his journey toward effective leadership through listening. My education in leadership began in Washington when I was an assistant to Defense Secretary William Perry. He was universally loved and admired by heads of state in our own and allied troops. A lot of that was because of the way he listened. Each person who talked to him had his complete, undivided attention. Everyone blossomed in his presence because he was so respectful. And I realized I wanted to affect people the same way. Perry became my role model, but that was not enough. Something bigger had to happen, and it did. It was painful to realize how often I just pretended to hear people. How many times had I barely glanced up from my work when a subordinate came into my office? I wasn't paying attention. I was marking time until it was my turn to give orders. That revelation led me to a new personal goal. I vowed to treat every encounter with every person on Benfold as the most important thing at that moment. It wasn't easy, but my crew's enthusiasm and ideas kept me going. It didn't take me long to realize that my young crew was smart, talented, and full of good ideas that usually came to nothing because no one in charge had ever listened to them. I decided that my job was to listen aggressively. Command a warship effectively? A warship is a setting in which the officers talk and the sailors learn but one thing. Shut up and do as you're told, right? Captain Abershoff tells us, wrong. 13.7. Listening is an action word. Language to deliberately consider. Fierce listening. Aggressive listening. These two words are extraordinarily important. Each is an action word. One tends to think of listening as a passive activity. Wrong, wrong, wrong. Listening is 100% about engaging. It is, in fact, the most emotionally intense of human activities. Listening equals active action. I firmly believe that if, after a half an hour conversation, you are not exhausted, you were not seriously, fiercely, aggressively attentive. 13.8. Listening, core value number one. Number one equals number one. Suggested core value number one. We are effective listeners. We treat listening excellence as the centerpiece of our commitment to respect and engagement and community and growth. There are numerous legitimate candidates for the number one slot in your set of core values, but if you buy into the commentary in this chapter, then listening is a good choice for that top slot, right? This is a stretch. Or is it? Please ponder. 13.9.1. Sir Richard says, Part 1. Listen. Fully one-third of Richard Branson's most recent book, The Virgin Way, How to Listen, Learn, Laugh, and Lead, is devoted to listening. He says at one point, the key to every one of our 8 leadership attributes was the vital importance of a leader's ability to listen. This stunned me. I've surely read hundreds of books on leadership. Listening was doubtless alluded to, but this? Repeat, one-third of the entire book. Over 100 pages. The first 100-plus pages. Listening. Per se. 13.9.2. Multiplier. Take notes. Branson is also an avid, fanatic note-taker. He has accumulated hundreds of notebooks over the years. Note-taking, he says, is the key to effective listening. Among other things, note-taking forces you to pay attention. It also signals the other party that you are serious, that you take her or him seriously. Your implicit message is, you have things to say that are of value to me, things that provide me new data, things that signal the state of the organization. For the duration of our time together, you are the most important person in my life. Bonus. Note-taking also forcibly keeps you from spending your listening time preparing your clever, self-serving retort. This is not a guru's throwaway line. Solid research confirms that the centerpiece of most people's listening practice is preparing their next, doubtless brilliant, interjection. 13.10. Commentary from Twitter. Tweets on listening from my tweet stream. I always write listen on the back of my hand before a meeting. I started doing this. It helps. And it's been one of the most retweeted remarks in my Twitter feed. Try it. If you are listening and in your mind preparing your response, then, duh, you aren't listening. People are on to you. They are able in a flash to discern that even though you asked the question, you are not tuned in to their response. If you ask a question and don't ask 2 or 3 follow-up questions, odds are you weren't listening to the answer. I grew up near railroad crossings. As kids, we had drummed into us, stop, look, listen. Bosses should religiously heed this advice. Listening is a purposeful act requiring effort and 100% attention. There is nothing casual or automatic about it. Listening is expensive and time-consumed. It's just that the alternative is far more expensive. Michael Pollo tweet, "Nothing beats eye-to-eye or ear-to-ear. Asking questions and listening with a smile is raw power." Raw power. Thank you, Michael. 13.11. The Good Listener's Rules. A sampler. Herewith. A good listener exists totally for the conversation. There is nothing else on earth of any importance to me for these 5, 10, 30 minutes. To borrow from Susan Scott again, listening success equals fierce attentiveness. A good listener gives the other person time to stumble toward clarity without interruption. A 10 or 20 second pause, 45 second pause, when someone is thinking before talking is not an invitation to interrupt. Damn it. A good listener becomes invisible, makes the respondent the centerpiece. My friend Dennis Litke, founder of Big Picture Learning, had an interesting habit, which we caught on film for a PBS show on leadership. He would enter, for example, a 10th grade classroom and go to the student's desk to chat. Dennis was principal of Thayer High School in Winchester, New Hampshire at the time. When he got to the desk, he would reflexively get down on his knees so that he was looking up at the student. Talk about a change in the standard dynamic. A good listener does not ever take a call, even from her or his boss. A good listener takes extensive notes. A good listener calls, better than emails, damn it, a couple of hours later to thank the other for her or his time. A good listener calls the next day with a couple of follow-up queries. A good listener does not pontificate. Remember, if you ain't exhausted after a serious conversation, then you were not really listening. 13.12. Listening. Last words. Never miss a good chance to shut up. Will Rogers. Chapter 14. Frontline Leadership Excellence. The Most Undervalued Asset. My story. You will defer to the chiefs. Back to those formative U.S. Navy days. Upon arrival in Vietnam, my battalion had convoyed to our camp at Red Beach outside of Da Nang. Of the officer complement of about 30, 6 of us were ensigns, the lowest-ranking commissioned officers. O-1s is the military lingo. Our crusty commanding officer, the star of the opening story in Chapter 1 on execution, made it clear to us that we were starting off as second-class citizens, regardless of that fresh, shiny gold bar on our collars that signified officer status. At one point early in his on-the-beach initiation speech, he said, as I recall, and I think it's pretty accurate, I can still hear him, "There is a key to your success, and it is a key to which I will brook no exceptions. You will, that is, will, take your cues from your chiefs." Chiefs, chief petty officers, are the Navy's highest-ranking enlisted men. They are the old pros who have seen it all, including a parade of clueless young officers. He continued, "They know their business, and they wouldn't be where they are in my command unless they had won the respect of their sailors. Fact is, boys, they run this show." The chiefs are the leaders who supervise the work of the ship, or, in my case described here, the work of U.S. Naval Mobile Construction Battalion 9. The chiefs run the Navy, and the sergeants run the Army. And in private enterprise, the first-line bosses serve the same role. The first-line bosses are the ones with direct contact with those who do the actual work. What role, and role holders, could be more important in U.S. Naval Mobile Construction Battalion 9 or in the Honda dealership in your town? Answer, none. The chiefs, sergeants, first-line bosses connect the aspirations of the business to the people who do the work. The chiefs, sergeants, first-line bosses animate and exemplify the culture of the organization. Implicit in these last two sentences is, for good or for ill. Per my way of thinking, the full set of first-line chiefs, bosses, leaders are no less than asset number one on the organization's balance sheet. This is a short chapter, but it is a topic clearly worthy of a chapter. Most all would agree that the first line boss's role is important, but damn few see the virtually limitless value of their full cadre of first line leaders. I hope these next pages will be the impetus for a rethink. I listened to my commanding officer and I took him damn seriously. It changed my life. I made it clear to my chief, Master Chief Olson, that I agreed that I was basically clueless and needed all the advice and mentoring he'd be willing to give. We became fast friends, and through him I wormed my way into the chief's world, learned at the speed of light, had a superb deployment, and went forward from there in the Navy and beyond. Some of my ensign peers were a little bit too aware of that little gold bar on their collars, were standoffish with the chiefs, and learned less and got less done than I did, and earned the ire of Captain Dick Anderson, our commanding officer. The final upshot of the little saga here is, in fact, this chapter in my book. The First Line Chief's Narrative. 14.1. First Line Chiefs are key number one to organizational effectiveness, and we invariably way underplay their collective importance. Fact. If the regimental commander lost most of his second lieutenants and first lieutenants and captains and majors, it would be a tragedy. If he lost his sergeants, it would be a catastrophe. Fact. The Army and the Navy are fully aware that success on the battlefield is dependent to an overwhelming degree on its sergeants and chief petty officers. That is, its population of frontline managers. Does industry have the same awareness? My answer, no. Do enterprises think that getting the right person to fill a frontline boss slot is important? Yep. But the collection of frontline bosses as asset number one? No. Not getting this is a strategic mistake of the first order. 14.2. Asset number one equals asset number one. Frontline chiefs. Principal determinants of enterprise productivity. Principal determinants of employee retention. Principal determinants of product and service quality. Principal carriers, embodiments of corporate culture. Principal visible spear carriers for excellence. Principal champions, enablers of sustained employee development. Is this list extreme? After years of observation of organizations of all flavors and sizes, I do not think this is overstatement. In fact, it is almost tautological. I reiterate, full complement of first-line bosses. We should always think in terms of the population of first-line bosses collectively, not just Ms. Smith or Mr. Jones. 14.3. First-line chiefs unequivocally drive employee retention, satisfaction, productivity. Marcus Buckingham is acknowledged as one of the shrewdest analysts of enterprise effectiveness. He also had access to a treasure trove of data at the Gallup organization. His book, with Kurt Kaufman, First, Break All the Rules, What the World's Greatest Managers Do Differently, is considered by many, including me, to be a masterpiece. Mr. Buckingham also is as rabid on the topic of frontline leadership as I am, maybe more so. And, as I said, he's collected and analyzed the data to back up that assertion. In Break All the Rules, he concludes that the variables that matter most to the organization, such as productivity, quality, and employee retention, are overwhelmingly based on the first-line manager. Another shrewd, long-time organizational observer whom I met at TomPeters.com, Dave Wheeler, commented, "People leave managers, not companies." A couple of years ago, our farm manager in Vermont decided he needed a bit more stability in his life. We were considering selling the farm, which we eventually did. He was a gem. He could have invented the word reliable, and he had an unshakable thirst for picking up new skills. He got a job in a flash at an excellent local company with a great reputation for all the right stuff. And yet he left after 6 months. We talked about it a lot, but in the end he could not deal with the constant whining of his first line boss. The work was great, he told me over the course of a series of conversations, but I came home half the time with a headache. He was not a whiner in the most adverse of situations, but his boss was at the best of times. Score one for Mr. Wheeler's assessment above. People leave managers, not companies, no matter how good the company. Take together these assertions by Mr. Buckingham, Mr. Wheeler, and my former farm manager, and you end up with a solid case for my asset number one assertion. Serious about first line leaders? Yes. Serious enough? No. I'm openly pushing here for nothing short of a very visible obsession with our full portfolio of first-line chiefs. Among the many things I've championed in my work in recent times, this emphasis on first-line chiefs seems to have had the most resonance with top bosses and led to the most serious reassessments and action. One big bank CFO said to me, "I typically ran my department by working with my direct reports, senior middle managers. But after your nudge, I've changed my approach. I have individually and collectively and directly reached out to our first-line supervisors. And as a result, I've gotten a different feel for the organization as a whole and a real appreciation for that group. As I move forward, we're constructing, for one thing, an intensive mentoring program for our front-line leaders." The CEO of a major chemical company echoed the bank exec. "After your session with our top team, we started talking more about the frontline leader role. We discovered we were frighteningly casual about both selection and development. And through surveys, we were stunned at the variable quality of the frontline bosses. We're not just working on fixing things. We're taking a proactive role in thinking, as you suggested, in terms of major corporate asset. I'll let you know how it works out, but awareness is a big step forward." 14.4. First-line chiefs' excellence as a core corporate value. Suggested addition to your statement of core values. We are obsessed with developing a cadre of first-line managers that is second to none. We understand that this cadre is arguably one of our organization's most important strategic assets. 14.5. Seven key questions about your first-line chiefs. 1. Do you absolutely understand and act upon the fact that the first-line boss is the key leadership role in the organization? 2. Does HR single out first-line supervisors individually and collectively for special, over-the-top developmental attention? 3. Do you spend gobs and gobs of time selecting first-line supervisors? 4. Are you willing, pain notwithstanding, to leave a vacant first-line supervisor slot open until you can fill the slot with someone spectacular? 5. Do you have the absolute best training and continuing development programs in the industry for first-line supervisors? 6. Do you formally and rigorously and continually mentor first-line supervisors? 7. Are your first-line supervisors accorded the attention and acknowledgement and respect that the importance of their position merits? 14.6.1. Suggested step number one toward first-line boss excellence, getting to know you. Make it a point in the next month to spend a big dose of quality time with each of your first-line chiefs. 14.6.2. Suggested step number two toward first-line boss excellence, programmatic reallocation. Consider: cut your executive development budget by 25% or more. Put every penny of the savings into frontline manager training and development. If my assessment in this chapter is accurate, such a reallocation of resources will have a significant mid to long-term strategic payoff. Chapter 15. 26 Tactics to Spur Leadership Excellence, Guaranteed to Work. My story. It was pre-dawn in Manhattan, January 27, 1983. Bob Waterman and I were in the NBC green room waiting to be interviewed for the Today Show by Bryant Gumbel, concerning the surprising success of our new book, In Search of Excellence. Bob turned to me and said nonchalantly, "Well, who gets to say it on national television?" I had no idea what he was talking about and answered with, "Huh?" "MBWA," he replied. "Who gets to say MBWA on national TV?" Bob was senior. He said it. 35 years later, I still haven't gotten over the fact that I didn't get to say to Mr. Gumbel, "Let me tell you about MBWA." But let's go back to 1979. The research for what became In Search of Excellence was in its infancy. The title of our work was undistinguished, the McKinsey Organization Effectiveness Project. We were interviewing folks here and there. On our list of candidates were execs from our near neighbor in Palo Alto. We were birthed in San Francisco. A feisty, still relatively youthful, innovative company called Hewlett-Packard. The extraordinary experience with HP began with my efforts to secure an interview with the president, John Young. I called the main HP phone number and assumed, as would be the case with the giant firms we were used to dealing with, such as Chase Manhattan, that I would be passed through a string of secretaries and executive assistants who just might schedule an interview in the distant future. I reached company reception and asked to speak to Mr. Young. In what must have been all of 10 seconds, a gruff voice comes on the line. "This is John Young. Who's this?" Ye gads. In a flash, with no muss and fuss, an interview was arranged 2 days hence. Bob and I took the 25-mile trip to Palo Alto and were soon seated in John's cramped office, an 8x8 half-walled cubicle amid the engineering spaces. At some point in the conversation, MBWA spilled out of Mr. Young's mouth. I think he was talking about the famous HP way. It would be called culture code or some such today, and said that the cornerstone was this odd, to us, thing labeled MBWA. Bob and I didn't know it then, but as of that utterance, everything changed in our professional lives. MBWA, as it seems half the world knows today, is managing by wandering around. And it meant managing by wandering around. The real meaning was that you can't lead from your office or cubicle. You lead on the shop floor, or for that matter, in the customer's or vendor's place of business. You lead, damn it, by staying in direct touch with the action that matters. And it gets harder and harder and harder as the company gets bigger and bigger and bigger. HP had just passed the $1 billion revenue mark when we made our initial visit. Indeed, alas, their special character has taken a big hit as their size has exploded. To stick with 1979, the United States was getting hammered by the Japanese. As mentioned at the outset of the book, MBAs and their ilk were in the driver's seat at most giant U.S. companies, and the extant practice was MBTN, or MBSP, or MBMP, or all three. Management by the numbers, or management by strategic plan, or management by marketing plan. Decisions were effectively made in the analyst's office. The shop floor, or even the engineering spaces, were foreign soil. The Japanese, on the other hand, were in direct touch with their product and with the people who made it, and it damn well was reflected in, say, superior automobile quality, which was sinking Detroit's Big Three. MBWA was and is a peerless idea. And the faster things change, think 2018, the more important MBWA becomes. In fact, MBWA for me has become not a thing to regularly do, but a metaphor for a way of life and style of leadership fit for eternity and, especially, fit for these crazy times. MBWA means jumping directly into the fray, not via spreadsheets, which are important to the extent that they are realistic, few are, but through conversation at the proverbial coalface, where the grubby digging is done. Bob got to say MBWA on the Today Show, and I've subsequently gotten to say it over a dozen times in over a dozen or so books, and 2,500 times in about 2,500 speeches. And, alas, it remains news, in the truest sense of that root word, new. The average harried manager remains tied to her or his desk or screen and over time loses touch with reality. Advanced artificial intelligence may be reading faces on screens and assessing moods with some accuracy, but being in touch with all one's senses and with every sort of player in the organization remains of the utmost importance, remains the heart of the matter. This leadership chapter is written in the spirit of MBWA. Nothing fancy, no vision, no charisma, just TTDT, things to do today. Get out and about. Do your MBWA. Say thank you a dozen times over. Ask, what do you think, to anyone whose path you cross. Take someone interesting and off your normal radar to lunch today. Don't push send until you've allowed the content of the email to percolate, and about 21 other items that come under the heading of stuff. True transformation, the word I usually avoid like the plague, will mainly come from a dozen new little habits, not from some bullshit value statement that 9 out of 10 employees find laughable because the isolated boss is so unaware of the degree to which it has no impact or veracity in the field where, to repeat myself, the real work, as always, is done. The Leadership Tactics Narrative 15.1.1 MBWA. A desk is a dangerous place from which to view the world. John Le Carré. A body can pretend to care, but they can't pretend to be there. Texas Bix Bender. As you might guess from the chapter introduction, MBWA earns pride of place in this leadership chapter. It is the epitome of stuff to do, guaranteed, yes, guaranteed, to make you a more effective leader. And, alas, stuff that all too often falls by the wayside in the midst of the chaos of a normal day at work. The good MBWA intentions are not fulfilled, for good reasons mostly, and you end the day one more degree out of touch than you were when the sun came up. Soon, alas, you will become an MBM, managerial blind man, awash in numbers and spreadsheets, clueless about the real world, and, believe it, big data and algorithmic voodoo ain't gonna save you, my friend. I am bullheaded on this topic and proud of it. 15.1.2 MBWA, the rule of 25. I'm always stopping by our stores, at least 25 a week. I'm also in other places, Home Depot, Whole Foods, Crate and Barrel. I try to be a sponge to pick up as much as I can. Howard Schultz, Starbucks, Fortune, Secrets of Greatness. There is no doubt that Howard Schultz has a dozen pressing issues to deal with every day. And yet, by hook or by crook, he forcibly makes time to get out and into a bushel of his shops. His staff is doubtless first rate, and God alone knows how many terabytes of data Starbucks collects on a daily basis, and considering earlier commentary on the likes of the augmented memory flavor of AI, the data may well go so far as to record the second-to-second mental status of every one of Starbucks' gazillion shop employees. And yet Schultz puts aside the crucial meeting on the next $70 million supply chain software upgrade and hits the road. He said to me that when Starbucks got in trouble a few years ago, a large part of his problem was that he had stayed home plotting the future and in the process lost touch with the intangibles, the feel of what it was like to be one of his customers or employees. There are no sinners in this MBWA saga. The boss is paid to deal with problems. And every day presents, via, say, the morning report and a dozen new emails, 2 or 3 or 9 unexpected crises. And as she should, she dives in and deals with them. In a flash, it's 5:45 p.m. or 6:45 p.m., and the visit she'd planned to the distribution center, or even the drop-by with the purchasing team down the hallway, has gone by the boards. No MBWA today, alas. Bottom line. Schultz, greater than 25 shops per week, proves intensive MBWA can be wedged in to the busiest of schedules. 15.1.3 MBWA, Grameen Style. Muhammad Yunus won the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize for effectively inventing microlending, which has had a significant impact on the world's poorest people. His leading vehicle was the Grameen Bank. Yunus shares with us, in Banker to the Poor, an important aspect of his approach. Conventional banks ask their clients to come to their office. It's a terrifying place for the poor and illiterate. The entire Grameen Bank system runs on the principle that people should not come to the bank should go to the people. If any staff member is seen in the office, it should be taken as a violation of the rules of the Grameen Bank. It is essential that those setting up a new village branch have no office and no place to stay. The reason is to make us as different as possible from government officials. To use my overused term, I do out and out love this. The bankers should have no office and no place to stay. Call it MBWABYHNA. MBWA because you have no alternative. Bravo. 15.1.4. MBWA. Fun. Sure. You do MBWA to stay in touch with the action. I just said that, demanded it, and commanded it, in fact. But there's a much better reason to do it. It's fun. Yes, fun. Hang out with the folks doing the work. What the hell else is the reason to be in business? It's fun, or damn well should be, at 1 a.m. to spend an hour on the loading dock chatting up the team. Yes, you collect invaluable impressions, but hanging out with the team, fun at one or you're in the wrong job. Doing MBWA will, I hope, remind you of why you got into business in the first place. Not to mention that the residual of the walkabout, a workforce jazzed up by the acknowledgement and care you've given them, is contributor number one to the bottom line. The origin of my MBWA is fun assertion was a beach walk in New Zealand in February 2017. I got to thinking about why one goes into business, and got to thinking, as I often do, about MBWA. There was a duh moment after all these 35 years since I came across the term. Holy crap, you do MBWA because it's fun. And everything else you get out of it is a side benefit, albeit, as it was for Howard Schultz when he'd gotten out of touch, one hell of a game-changing side benefit. 15.1.5. MBWA. The devil, as always, is in the quality of the eye contact. Yes, I rant and rave about the importance of doing your daily MBWA, but missing is the all-important how to do, or even more important, how not to do. The topic merits an extended discussion. But space here permits only a passing comment or two, aimed in particular at senior execs. Sin number one, MBWA as head of state visit. Remember, you are on the shop floor to listen and engage. You are not there to pontificate. Sin number two, the retinue problem. The big boss accompanied by a passel of bored, stiff, overdressed underlings. The personal touch evaporates, and often as not, you induce terror, or worse, smirks, which likely makes the visit a net negative. Easy solution. Go by yourself. Sin number three, the distracted look. People can tell in a flash exactly where your mind is. When you have a distracted look or are antsy, you once again turned a huge potential positive into a net negative. On and on I could go. Instead, I'll conclude with a pair of examples of MBWA when it really counts. General Ulysses S. Grant's MBWA was what I label CWVA. In Grant's words, I can command while visiting and traveling about. His approach on the morning before a skirmish is described by Gene Edward Smith in the book Grant. Above all, the troops appreciated Grant's unassuming manner. Most generals went about attended by a retinue of immaculately tailored staff officers. Grant usually rode alone. Another soldier in his diary said the troops looked on Grant as a friendly partner, not an arbitrary commander. Instead of cheering as he rode by, they would greet him as they would address one of their neighbors at home. Good morning, General. Pleasant day, General. The respect General Grant showed for his troops also extended to the enemy. Here's an excerpt in Smith's book from a Confederate soldier's diary following surrender to Grant's army. The other Union officers had ridden, quote-unquote, smugly past the defeated soldiers. Then, the diarist reports, when General Grant reached the line of ragged, filthy, bloody, despairing prisoners strung out on each side of the bridge, he lifted his hat and held it over his head until he passed the last man of that living funeral cortege. He was the only officer in that whole train who recognized us as being on the face of the earth. General Dwight D. Eisenhower took a page from Grant's book. Find a photo of Ike from the night before or morning of D-Day. He, too, ventured out alone and in a uniform as plain as that of the private first class or corporal he was addressing. His face was a model of genuine empathy for which he was known, and the exchange was one-to-one, just a few words usually uttered in a near whisper with his hand invariably on the young soldier's shoulder. This is MBWA at its most potent. The Grant and Eisenhower examples are a long way from the distribution center or IT team space, but the idea is exactly the same. 15.1.6 MBPA, managing by phoning around, the rule of 60. I call 60 CEOs in the first week of the year to wish them Happy New Year. Hank Paulson, former CEO Goldman Sachs, former U.S. Secretary of the Treasury. For what it's worth, since 1973, and without fail, I have practiced a version of this. I religiously make between 25 and 50 thank you calls at Christmas and New Year's. The positive feedback is nothing short of astounding, which, of course, confirms the rarity of the practice. Addenda. There are no guarantees in life is a common saying, and I agree, mostly. But in this instance, I will break the rule. Making your 25 to 50 thank you calls at year's end includes a guarantee. I guarantee that it will pay off, professionally and personally, 100 times over. And, as a bonus, it's immensely pleasurable. I guarantee that, too. 15.1.7 MBFFA, managing by frequent flying around. I am continually told that this MBWA stuff is not practical, that is, not even possible, in the age of dispersed e-managed teams. To some extent, and by definition, sure. But let's not throw in the whole towel. If I were leading an important dispersed project team, I would find some way, begging, borrowing, stealing, or using personal funds if necessary, to make the rounds. For want of a better term, I'll call it MBFFA, managing by frequent flying around, maybe quarterly. Leadership 1818 or 1918 or 2018. Face to face is imperative. Damn it. In 2018. Damn it. I am told by old people, say 35-year-olds, that young people just don't get this. For heaven's sake, messaging across the breakfast table is more or less the norm. I understand, but precisely because of this, I believe more strongly than ever that face-to-face is priceless. My conversations with commanders of big projects almost unfailingly support my view, and it sure as hell works for me in my professional affairs. Bosses of bosses, in this age of dispersed teams, do not cut the travel budget regardless of how cash-strapped you may be. MBWA. MBFFA. Period. Damn it. 15.2. The mind-blowing rule of 50. Most managers spend a great deal of time thinking about what they plan to do, but relatively little time thinking about what they plan not to do. As a result, they become so caught up in fighting the fires of the moment that they cannot really attend to the long-term threats and risks facing the organization. So the first soft skill of leadership the hard way is to cultivate the perspective of Marcus Aurelius. Avoid busyness, free up your time, stay focused on what really matters. Let me put it bluntly. Every leader should routinely keep a substantial portion of his